there's danger everywhere. But danger had never looked quite like this before.
Can you keep a secret?
Based on shocking true events.
This girl, Rena Virk, she's been missing for 3 days.
Emmy Award nominee Riley Keough.
Young girls were the ones we were supposed to protect.
Academy Award nominee Lily Gladstone.
Can't be.
Not be protected from.
A Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays only on Hulu.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Thinking Sideways is not brought to you by the Manganese Transporters Association of America. Instead, it's supported by the generous contributions of people like you, our listeners, on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/thinkingsideways to learn more.
Thinking Sideways.
I don't understand.
Does not compute.
You never know.
Insufficient data to formulate a reply.
What?
Stories of things we simply don't know the answer to.
Hey there, and welcome again to another episode of Thinking Sideways. I am Steve, of course, as always, joined by...
Devin.
And Joe.
And once again, we have a mystery.
What?
Once again, we have a listener-suggested mystery.
What? And it's an aeronautical mystery.
It is.
What?
And yes, I know there's probably somebody out there going, oh God, Steve's doing another plane mystery. But hang with us because I actually sort of managed to find a story that combines my last two episodes.
Yeah, plus aliens.
Like I said, my last two episodes.
Okay, fair enough.
So today's story was a listener suggestion. As I said, it was suggested by Mr. W. So thank you, sir.
Thanks, Doug.
And this week, what we're going to be talking about is Air Force pilot Captain Craig D. Button, who died when his A-10 Thunderbolt II, better known as a Warthog, crashed into the side of Gold Dust Peak in the Rocky Mountain Range in Colorado. Button had apparently gone completely off mission. He had no reason to be in that area.
He kind of did. He sort of wandered off the reservation.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
So before we get into the mystery, let's do a little bit of backstory here. Let's talk about Mr. Button.
Why was he named Button?
That was his last name. That was the name his parents gave him, which their parents probably gave before them. That's how this works, Joe.
Okay.
Well, one of their parents gave them.
One of them. Well, they were both married, so they would have... this is... Never mind. Let's just keep moving forward.
How does this name thing work?
Oh, it's going to be a long night. Craig Button, at the time of his death, he was 32 years old. He had been flying planes since his late teens, and he was always described as a straight shooter. He didn't smoke. He almost never drank. He went to college at the New York Institute of Technology, and while he was there, he was in the Air Force ROTC program, which, for people who don't know, is the Reserve Officer Training Corps. And while he was there, when he graduated, he got a degree in aerospace engineering, which
smart,
doesn't...
Smart guy. That's probably not easy to get.
I don't imagine that is an easy degree, no.
It's too bad he crashed his plane, Guy had a lot going for him.
He really did.
Hey, did we say what year this is?
This is in 1997.
Okay.
Is when this whole thing goes down.
Sorry, I just realized I had no idea what time frame we were looking
at. Well, that's because I was giving the backstory first, and then we were going to jump forward to the actual time.
Okay.
So we are not yet in 1997. We are instead in the early 90s when he was in college. He graduated and almost, it sounds like basically immediately turned around and went into the U.S. Air Force.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of the way ROTC works. I think they give you a scholarship and then you turn around and you got to kind of join.
You kind of got to repay it
in a way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, the thing is that he seemed to be totally happy in the Air Force. He initially, after basic training, he spent 4 years at Laughlin Air Force Base, which is in Texas. He was a flight instructor there. And then later, after that four-year stint, he transferred to Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, which is in Arizona. He was going to go into the training program for flying the A-10.
I'd love to fly a Warthog.
It's a cool plane. We should talk about it. We should talk about it real quick.
Because I don't know what...
You probably do, and I think a lot of people do know what the Warthog is by look. You just probably don't know the name.
Okay.
It's a very distinct-looking plane. It's a single-seater, so there's no co-pilot. It's just the pilot. It's got kind of a stubby nose in the front, and the kind of horizontal tail, the H-shaped tail, which means there's the horizontal fin and then a vertical on each side.
Okay.
But the most distinguishing feature is its engines, which are mounted on between the wing and the tail and above them, and mounted directly onto the fuselage. So it's got these big, huge turbines attached to the side of it.
Yeah.
And
it's an ugly plane, but I think it's pretty in its own way. And the other thing about it, too, is it doesn't have like your typical jets. Unlike your typical jets, it doesn't have the swept-back stubby wings.
No, they're straight.
Nice, big, straight, horizontal, rectangular wings, which is great because it gives it a really nice, really low stall speed.
Yeah.
Stall speed on that thing is 120 miles an hour, and that's without flaps. Because I saw one at an air show once, and he flew right by in front of us, really low.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really low. And then it just turned his nose up like this and took off again. But I can swear he was going a lot slower than 120 miles an hour.
For folks who don't know, stall speed is when the thing stops flying.
Yeah, it's when it starts to fall instead of flying. Exactly.
But no, they're really cool. They're very blatantly designed for one thing, and that is blowing stuff up, though.
Yeah.
It's got that stubby nose because it's got a giant 30-millimeter cannon in the nose, and that cannon, the fuselage of the body, the plane is actually built around that cannon. It's so huge.
Mm-hmm.
The wings are meant to hold all kinds of munitions. I saw a picture of one that was banking, and it looked, I think there was a total of 10 projectiles on it. Mm-hmm. So it was all kinds of different missiles and bombs, and the thing was just like bristling for wars. Like, don't mess with it. It's going to throw everything.
And plus that 30-millimeter cannon can really lay down some fire.
Yeah, it drops an amazing amount of ammunition in a second. Mm-hmm. It's really crazy.
It shoots the depleted uranium bullets. And
when they want to be armor piercing, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And they can take out a tank real easy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where that slow stall speed really comes in handy, because if you're going over like a column, like a tank column or something like that, you can kind of take your sweet time and just, you know, and get lots of rounds into each one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah.
Rather than going as fast as you can and hoping that you hit them with something. Yes.
Yeah.
So and it has a military advantage.
Yeah. And just to editorialize a little bit, periodically the Air Force announces that they're going to phase out the A-10. They've done it at least a couple of times now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's a ploy to just get Congress to pony up more cash. The Air Force just says, you know, we want to phase out the A-10 because, you know, we just think that if we, you know, do away with supply lines and support personnel and all that stuff, it'll save us a bunch of money that we can put towards our fancier stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else says, are you freaking crazy?
And then
Congress ponies up a little more money.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think they really intend to.
They've been in service for a long time.
Well, they're planning on keeping them in service for a whole lot longer.
Well, but that's what I mean. Is they've been in service for a long time. As far as I looked at it, it doesn't appear that they're making new A-10s.
No,
they're just maintaining their existing stock.
Yeah,
so.
And they built a lot of these things.
They did. They really did. Enough about the A-10. we're going to go ahead and we're going to jump to February of 1997.
Okay.
Button started his A-10 training at Davis-Monthan on the 3rd of February. It's a 82-day program, so he should have been done sometime in the spring. And at that point, he was scheduled to transfer out to... Oh, Joe, you're going to have to help me with the name of this airbase.
I think it's Spangdahlem.
Okay, I'll go with that. Which is
Spangdahlem.
Yeah, which is an airbase in Germany. So upon completion of his training, he already had orders to ship out mm-hmm. to somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So he was expected to obviously pass his training. We're going to move about 2 months into his training to the 2nd of April, 1997. Button and two other planes take off. They have a mission where they're going to fly from Davis-Monthan Air Force Base to what's called the Goldwater Gunnery Range, which is kind of near Gila Bend, Arizona. And for a bit of reference, Gila Bend is on the very bottom edge of the state. It's about 100 miles or 160 kilometers from the Mexico border.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also about 100 miles, I believe it is, west of the actual Air Force Base. So it's kind of in the middle of nowhere.
And where's Davis-Monthan?
It's about 100 miles or so from Phoenix, Arizona.
Okay.
That's an off the top of my head.
Sure,
ballpark,
but it's in Arizona somewhere.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually these bombing ranges are usually kind of out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
That's where you want it.
For good reason.
Yeah.
Because you don't want a bunch of people around. So the U.S. Air Force, they don't typically make their practice runs a straight line. You want to get some time on the stick. So they were known for doing things like circling around the state and taking kind of a roundabout route to get to the gunnery range. And indeed, that appears to be what they did. Before they got to the gunnery range, all of the planes in his formation fueled up. So in-air fueling, which is not an easy thing. We were just talking about this. It's like trying to get a straw at 400 miles an hour onto something below you. It sounds amazingly difficult.
Well, the thing below you is also moving at 400 miles an hour.
But all the wind speed is really what I'm reacting to.
Yeah.
And they probably don't do it at 400 miles an hour.
No, it's definitely hard, though.
It's crazy.
I would think, and especially in turbulence, and there's turbulence quite a lot of the time out
mm-hmm.
there.
Yeah. So they go through this fueling process, and then Button drops back behind the other two planes in a bit of a follow the leader formation, and this is expected. And then all of a sudden, he turns, and he leaves the formation, and the mission leader sees him flying away and calls him on the radio, but he doesn't respond. As a matter of fact, he's turned off. This plane, by the way, has three radios on it. He turns off all of his radios or stops responding to them, and he turns off his transponders for tracking purposes. And he just goes dark, and he just... poof, flies away and heads off in a northeasterly path, and he's gone.
Okay.
From there...
A little puzzler there.
It is, and the U.S. Air Force really didn't know what to make of it, and they had no idea what was going on, and it took nearly 2 weeks to piece together where he had gone and what had happened based on sightings from people on the ground, because, like we talked about, this plane is so recognizable. Its profile is very unique. And then they started finding records in airfield radar logs to say that they had spotted him, though nobody evidently got a hold of him.
That's interesting, isn't it? Doesn't that seem wrong?
It seems a little weird that nobody contacted him or recorded, I see this weird plane. What the hell's going on?
Yeah, I mean, if there's a plane, right, basically a bogey, that's not responding at all.
And it's not, nobody's recorded a flight plan or
anything
like that.
No, and like there's a report of it being like heavily laden with munitions. Are you going to be like,
well, they wouldn't see that on the radar.
They wouldn't report that, yeah.
But you don't know, like somebody might call. I don't know. Anyway,
well,
even if not.
U.S. Air Force thought that he had gone down somewhere in the area of where he had broke formation.
Okay.
So that is one thing to keep in mind.
Even if they didn't have reports of, you know, him having munitions or anything like that, it's still like a war vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
That's not responding. That's just
very expensive vehicle. Yes,
through, but that also, you know, any of the airspace that he was flying through was like, oh, We don't know why that's there, but okay, you're not responding, no problem. We won't send someone to figure out what's going on. You're definitely not going to do any kind of, like, terroristy, blowy, uppy things.
Well, now, the you know, a lot of the airfields he was going past, you're talking about people that pick him up on radar.
Small airfields.
Yeah, they're small airfields.
It's not like he was going past Denver International Airport and getting picked up.
And, yeah,
although that is the direction that he ends up going.
Yeah.
So let's, because they were able to piece all this together, we have an idea of his path. So he, after he breaks formation, he's spotted flying northeast past Lake Roosevelt, which is in Arizona, and that itself is about 100 miles or 160 kilometers northeast of Phoenix, and at about, and that's at about 12:30, and then he's seen passing near Telluride, Colorado around 1 o'clock that day. At 1:08 p.m., which is kind of a weirdly specific time, but he's spotted near Montrose, Colorado.
And when did he take off?
He took off just before noon, just several minutes before 12. So he made really good time.
So in an hour and 8 minutes, they were able to putz around and then do a refueling thing, and then he was able to take off?
Half hour.
Yeah. Well, by takeoff, I mean, when did he actually lift off from the ground?
Air Force Base. I have not seen the time that his flight group left.
Oh, okay.
I didn't see that recorded, so I can't answer that. Okay. All I do know is I know that the time that he broke away.
Okay.
So I don't know exactly how long he was in the air. So he then, at that point, like I said, he goes from Montrose. Before that point, he had been going in basically a straight line. He hadn't really been changing elevation, just he's cruising. From here, his flying changes rather dramatically. He is seen flying in kind of a zigzag pattern, and he's changing altitude. I think it was anywhere from 16,000 feet to 4,000 feet.
Not a great idea in the Rockies.
No, not a great idea in the Rockies. You're right. So here's what his path is that after 108, he turns a few degrees more east. So now he's going even more easterly. About 5 minutes or ish later, he does basically a 180-degree turn, and now he's heading south. And then about 5 minutes later, he turns again, and now he's heading northeast again for approximately another 5 or 10 minutes. And these are all approximates because it's based on, you know, sightings and stuff like that. But around 1:40 in the afternoon, the residents of Aspen and the area around it, they reported hearing a really loud explosion, and they said they saw smoke coming from the New York Mountain area.
Which is not far from Gold Dust Peak.
It's basically right next door.
Yeah, but and how far is that from Aspen?
Ballpark, I'm going to say that it's less than 50 miles.
Hmm.
That's a ballpark number off the top of my head. I didn't ever actually trace how far it was because I never got an exact point for where he hit. In other words, I never went to the satellite images and tried to find that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would ballpark about 50 miles, and I'm probably wrong. Mm. Well, what obviously, as you've probably guessed by some of the things that we've said so far, what those people heard was Craig Button's A-10 flying into the side of Gold Dust Peak.
It's 160 miles.
Okay, so I was wrong. It's three times as far as I thought it was.
But still pretty dang close.
Yes, still very close.
Greater scope of
things. So probably too far to actually hear the sound of the plane crashing.
No, I think that they could hear a bit of an explosion. You know, it's muffled over distance.
I mean, yeah, echoes and stuff like that.
Or maybe something else blew up. I mean, things do blow up.
They do.
Especially in the winter.
Yeah, so Button hits, he strikes the mountain at about 100 feet below its peak, or 30 meters below its peak. And by the way, the elevation of the peak of that mountain is around 13,200 feet, which is 4,000 meters.
By the way, was there cloud cover?
Yes, there was some cloud cover. He was seen flying around the clouds and ducking through holes in the clouds and coming in and out. So that's why people think, well, it's weird that he was so straight and then suddenly he was flying around the weather. It's very strange that he would be doing that all of a sudden. But I'm guessing if he's at a lower altitude, then it might become a problem at that point.
Yeah.
Okay, so Like I said, U.S. Air Force, it takes them a couple weeks to figure out what's going on. They then start combing the area, and they eventually find the crash site, and they're able to get people onto the mountain, which takes a little bit longer because the weather is really bad.
In April.
It's April. Yep. There's snow. Yep. It's Colorado. When they get there, though, they discover several things. The first of which is that they find the wreckage of his plane, and they find his body, and they find the computer that is on board the plane, but what they don't find is the bombs.
Mm-hmm. He dropped them.
Because, by the way, I didn't mention this, but his training run was using live ammunition.
Mm.
And the Warthog was carrying four 500-pound Mark 82 bombs.
What are those?
They're called the dumb bomb. Mm-hmm. They are not a guided missile of any way, shape, or form you can, but these were not. It is a 500-pound bomb that, when it hits the ground, causes a big hole and just blows stuff
but
up.
But just a normal bomb.
Yeah, it's kind of a general-purpose explosive.
It's not like a nuke or anything crazy.
No, not that conventional explosives, but, you know, they still...
I mean, obviously still devastating, but...
Oh, yeah. Not so. They fling... I've heard they can fling shrapnel for, like, a mile.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk about some of the specs on them in a bit, but they do some serious damage.
I just wanted to make sure we weren't talking like
no nukes,
no
crazy weapons,
weird uranium trade or something like that.
A dirty bomb.
Yeah,
I think it goes. It's pretty apparent here that the U.S. Air Force, as soon as they find everything and they figure out that the Mark 82s aren't there, they start combing the entire area around the crash site.
Oh yeah.
They make a very, very intense, I'm guessing it's, you know, it's I'm guessing that the kind of search they did was, you know, people on foot, not just circling overhead, because they're using things like ground penetrating radar within a several mile perimeter of where the crash happens. There's a lot of little lakes in that area. And so they actually started sending divers into those lakes with the idea that maybe the bombs dropped and they hit the water and they either were not activated or they didn't go off because they hit the water and sank, rather than going in nose first. And of course, this search, you know, like I said, it took him 2 weeks to figure out where he was, his plane had gone.
And then snowstorming.
Couldn't get right in away, so it takes several weeks to get there. So we're looking at like a month or two later.
Yeah.
Because they went and did an initial search, and then they had to stop because of the weather. And then when they got back there, because obviously the snow melt had happened, the debris field has shifted downhill. That's why it was kind of tough to figure out where everything was, but they're just looking everywhere because they want to know where the hell are these bombs.
Yeah, they're not like tiny.
No, they're not at all. They're pretty big.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about the Mark 82 is that the pilot has to arm the bomb. It is not as if they are flying around with something that it could just go off at any moment, because that's just foolish.
Oh, hell yeah.
But they were pretty sure that he hadn't armed the bombs, which is probably why they should just be laying somewhere and easily found.
Yeah, it's unlikely because, I mean, they knew his approximate flight course.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sure they flew over it looking for big craters. So that's one way to know that he didn't arm the bombs.
Yeah. Now, there's a couple of things here about it that I said the flight computer on the plane was found, and that would have recorded what he had done with the bombs. It wouldn't have recorded, say, where he would have dropped them, but it would have said where they dropped and were they armed when dropped.
I bet that wasn't the most weather-resistant computer, though.
Oh, it also wasn't very shock-resistant either, because the impact destroyed it and they couldn't recover any data off of it.
Of course not.
Now, I have read conflicting accounts of this next bit that we're going to talk about here, which is the racks on the wings of the plane. I've seen sources that said that the racks were not disengaged. In other words, think of it as a clamp. The clamp is engaged. It's going to be holding on to it and disengaged, it's going to be open. Mm-hmm. They said those clamps on the struts of the wings were still engaged, so he shouldn't have dropped the bomb. In other words, it couldn't. It's not as if when he drops them, they close again.
Mm. Yeah, no. So in other words, I've heard it both ways too. Although if he had crashed with the bombs attached,
they should have ripped free. I would imagine
the bombs
if they
would have ripped
right
free,
there.
But also the mounts would have been also seriously ripped and torn off too.
Yeah.
And the accounts that say that he released the bombs before, I've actually found more credible than the other accounts. So
yeah.
I think he released them well before his crash.
And he may very well, and that actually is kind of the end of the story, which actually leaves us with two different mysteries.
Yeah.
One, what did Button commit suicide? Because that's one of the main things you will hear. Why did he fly? What happened? Why was he there? Why did he break formation? And two, what happened to the Mark 82s?
Yeah.
So we have two mysteries, and we're going to start with the first one that I just brought up, which is, did he or did he not actually commit suicide? Because that is the most popular one, and you will see a lot of reporting on it, and you will get a lot of stuff from the U.S. Air Force that seems to indicate that he did intentionally commit suicide by mountain.
Mm-hmm. Poor mountain.
Just to clarify, real quick before we jump into these, he was like very talented, right?
He was a good
pilot.
The
Air Force like knew that he was talented.
Yeah, good pilot.
From the get-go, he was a good pilot.
Yeah. They don't let any idiot fly that plane.
Right, but like compared to his peers, was he like, you know, way better?
He was a flight instructor for several years, which I would take to indicate that he was skilled.
He really knew his stuff.
And as after that, I couldn't comment on how he ranked among his fellow airmen.
Cool.
Yeah, I would say he probably had been flying for since he was 17.
He knew how to fly a plane.
Probably was a good pilot.
A good pilot, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Okay, so first off, before we even get into the theories, I am going to say, reiterate that what we said earlier, which is he was considered a straight shooter. He didn't smoke. He didn't drink. And there is nothing that ever came up in his body that ever said that he had any substance abuse issues or that he was drunk at the time or anything crazy like that. So those are easy things to just sweep out of the way initially.
Also, there was also no evidence of hypoxia, right?
I saw thoughts about that, and we'll talk about that a little bit more later, but I don't believe that was the case.
Mm.
First sub-theory inside of suicide is the reason was family objections. From all of the accounts that I've read, Button was excited about the fact that he was going to get to transfer and go to Europe. He was happy where he was, and everybody seemed to think that he was in good shape. But according to this theory, he was actually semi-secretly struggling with his family's religious beliefs. His mother and father were Jehovah's Witnesses, and they had been in that religion they'd converted about 20 years prior to that. Mm-hmm. Now, officially, the Jehovah's Witnesses, they don't serve in the military. Pacifists. They don't believe in doing that. It's against their beliefs. And based on his age and how far back they had converted, I get the feeling that the family converted when he was a kid, you know, say 10, 12, somewhere in that age.
Setting his belief system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe that he actually became a member of the church, which would explain why he went into the Air Force.
Well, wasn't his dad also in the military?
A World War II and Vietnam era pilot, yes. But that was prior to the conversion.
Mm-hmm.
So he did that, and he served his military career before finding his faith.
Mm.
According to this, the thing is that his mother, because of their religious beliefs, she was not happy about him being in the military, and she tried to convince him to leave the military on a very regular basis. In some families, that is known as nagging mom.
Well, yeah.
I don't know how these conversations went, but I get the feeling that sometimes they weren't always the happiest affairs.
But, you know, I could think of alternatives to suicide if you got that issue. Number one, mom gets your way. Number two, you just don't talk to mom that much.
There's a number of ways around this, but we're going to continue on with it, even though Joe has a simple solution there.
Okay. That's what I would have done.
So, theory goes, Button experiences a crisis of faith when he realizes, as some people have said, he was being trained to kill people. And it was this crisis that made him decide, instead of just simply quitting, to take his own life.
To be fair, it's probably a little more complicated than that.
I'm simplifying this a lot.
Well, I just mean, if he did the ROTC program, right? Mm-hmm. He owed the U.S. government a ton of money. If he were to say, hey, I know you guys just paid for me to full ride through 4 years of college, but I'm not saying that he like actively owed, but I don't think you can just drop out of the military two months out.
No,
but they don't full ride you. Believe me, I remember guys, I was in college at the same time as this guy.
Yeah.
And I remember the kids in the ROTC program when I was there, and they got a healthy amount, but it wasn't as if the ROTC paid them a full ride, because college kids are unreliable, right, and they can't support every one of the little boogers.
Well, okay, so but he did.
He was required to serve a certain amount of time,
and he would have owed them a lot of money that he definitely wouldn't have been. I mean, ROTC because their parents can pay for their college because they're from really well off families, usually. Right? Because they need help paying for it.
Well, sure.
So
there's a percentage, yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's a little more complicated than like, oh, he could have just quit his job.
Well, no. I mean, nobody's saying he could have quit his job.
Right.
I mean, but his, even, you know, money aside, that's just not the way the military works.
Right.
You sign your papers, right. You're there
you
for four years or
right.
6 years
but,
or whatever.
Right, but, right. You know, there's also the thing called a transfer. You can say, I have an issue. I am now, I've taken on this faith and I cannot fly. And, you know, the military has to have somebody that cleans the bathroom.
Well, he could have gone back to being a flight instructor.
Yeah, he could have done a million things. Yeah.
But now here's the other thing is from what I've heard, he said he really enjoyed blasting away with that 30-millimeter cannon.
Yeah. And yeah,
well, who wouldn't?
Well, so that's the quote here.
And that's, you know, I mean...
Yeah. Here, let's get to that right now. So we're gonna go back to the family, which is the family had visited in March, both his parents, and they said it was a great visit, and he was happy, and there was no problems, there was no disagreements, and he apparently also, he kept in touch with the people that he had been renting from when he was stationed in Texas. And he had written them a letter, because this is back in the day when you still wrote real letters and sent them by mail.
Yeah, I remember letters.
Such an antiquated system. Oh, but no. So he sends them a letter. Strangely enough, they received that letter on the 2nd of April, 1997, which is a little weird. Mm. But the letter says, actually, Joe, do you mind reading this?
Flag is going fast.
No, in your voice, not in your German voice.
Okay. Quote, flying is going well. I love the A-10. Most everything we do is low level. I'll be dropping live bombs this week. The gun is a blast. Mm-hmm. My folks were down for a week just recently, and I took them to the Grand Canyon. Would you believe they had never been there before? Unquote.
So that
sounds pretty enthusiastic.
That sounds like a very excited, happy guy who's doing what he really likes to do.
Yeah, well, who wouldn't? I mean, you could blow things up and shoot things. I mean,
yeah, while flying through the air? Are you kidding me?
Oh, yeah, no, believe me. My dad was in the military for years, and he loved the fact that he got to blow stuff up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I will just add to this theory, the thing that we always say around suicides doesn't mean that he had to have been, I mean, you know, this isn't contingent on him have been, you know, particularly unhappy with that situation.
Mm-hmm.
He could have been hiding things. You know, people who appear happy kill themselves all the time.
It's true.
We don't want to belittle that.
No.
But let's talk about some other theories.
Yeah. So that is the end of that theory. So we're going to go to sub-theory two, which is the jilted lover theory.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like every time we do anything that's like air disappearance or military... or both really together, a military air disappearance. There's always the jilted lover and there's always the next one. They're the two.
Oh, well, what about the naval ones? The naval ones always have it.
Well, any
what about the UFO ones?
Any armed
half the US UFO ones have this in. I mean, actually, you know what? We should just make this a standard filler for all scripts.
Yeah, do a little because
it's in all of them.
Actually, don't we just fill out a form anyway?
Oh, we do. Yeah. It's the TPS report. That's the one.
Yeah, not the TSP, the TPS.
No, yeah, yeah. It's the TSP TPS.
Yeah.
That's the one we fill out.
It is.
Okay, so no, the jilted lover, according to this theory, when Button joined the Air Force, he had a relationship with another classmate, and according to this reporting, he kind of, sort of asked her to marry him, and she turned him down.
Oh, no.
And that apparently, he took that quite hard, and it took him several years to get over. She apparently called him in Christmas of 1996, and I don't know if they talked or it was just a left a message kind of scenario. I don't know.
I may be able to shed some light on this, having dated someone who was in basic training once, mm-hmm. which I think is similar to this.
Okay.
You can't call them.
Well, they were both in the service.
Oh.
They were both. She was also in the program.
I don't know how that deals with at that point. But
yeah.
It's hard to get in contact with people who are in this sort of basic training situation.
This is well past his basic training.
I'm sorry. Days. In any kind of training situation in the military, it is hard to get a hold of somebody.
Mm-hmm. Quite possibly. Maybe not now, but maybe back 20 years ago.
No, actually, it's still kind of hard. They cut down the lines of communication. They really kind of...
You don't get to have your cell phone out there in the trenches?
No.
Turns out Google Maps, not so good with the trenches.
Yeah.
Neither is Siri. Okay, so no, what happens here is in 96, apparently she calls. He calls her back on the 1st of April or calls her. I don't think they had had contact between Christmas and then. She's unable to talk at that time, though, and she takes his phone number down. And then she calls him back on the 5th or the 6th of April, unaware that he had taken his plane and gone AWOL. According to this theory, after we know this little bit about this lady, the theory goes that he realized that he was in love with her and she wouldn't talk to him, and that coupled with the fact, no joke, this is part of the theory, that he had bought a VCR and a copy of The Bridges of Madison County, that was what pushed him over the edge.
That's so sad. Is that the last movie that poor guy ever saw?
That's the one that he bought with the VHS player. And by the way, this theory, this comes from the psychological autopsy that was done by the U.S. Air Force. And yes. I've never heard of a psychological autopsy before.
I can sort of see that.
Can someone please tell me the plot of Bridges of Madison County?
Even
just the genre?
It is a sad, love not meant to be movie with Clint Eastwood and some other actress whose
Meryl
name
is Streep.
Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
And they want to be, but their lives won't let them. And boo hoo hoo.
I never saw that movie. I never want to.
Oh,
I don't ever want to see it.
I think I was forced to watch like 15 minutes once and then I ran.
I've never heard of it. So there you go.
It's got Clint Eastwood.
You'll be crying for weeks.
I'm a bad girl, I guess.
You are, but you know, I mean, seriously, to me, I don't want to see Clint Eastwood on the screen without a gun in his hand.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, seriously.
Really?
Although his son, Scott Eastwood, I would see him any day of the week.
All right, you too. Back on topic here. So we're going to move from that silly theory to another silly theory, which is suicide sub-theory 3, gay lover. Yep, this one's always in there as well. And I'm going to say right now, I couldn't substantiate this except for a few places which mentioned a supposed undisclosed U.S. Air Force insider who said that the Air Force had discovered that Craig Button was in the closet.
So this is not one of the Air Force's theories, then.
No, this is something that came out and has been out there for a while. Sorry, that was a bad turn of phrase. But this was out there for a while, and there's not a whole lot to this, Joe.
Nothing really
to back it up. Okay.
It's one paragraph, right?
Yeah, it's one and a half paragraphs, yes. And that's because I padded it with a little bit of history.
Yep.
So the story goes that one of Craig's previous lovers was planning to come forward and disclose their relationship. And today that doesn't seem like it's a big deal.
I'm sorry, I'm air quoting, wouldn't be a big deal.
It wouldn't be a big deal today.
Legally, shouldn't be a big deal, but...
But at the time, this is 97, and in 94, Bill Clinton had signed into effect, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which said that if you were in the closet, you could be a service member, but if you were out of the closet, you could not serve in any branch of the U.S. military. I mean, it's It's a huge known thing, but that would have meant, according to this law, that means that this person coming forward would have been the end of his military career.
Dishonorable discharge, right?
I'm not sure if it'd be dishonorable or John. No, court martial.
No, not by. I mean, in the days of McCarthy, yeah, that'd have totally been a court martial, but not at this point. But I think it was a discharge. It was definitely wasn't an honorable discharge either. But yeah, I don't remember the specifics of how they did it.
Yeah, there's like honorable, general, and dishonorable. And I don't think they're going to waste time on a court martial. Even back in the old days, they just discharge you.
Yeah,
you know,
send you on your way.
No sense wasting time on a trial, right? Mm-hmm. Well, what about Gay Suicide Pact? Have you thought of that?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
No, I haven't, and we're going to leave that alone because anywhere in here, but you just made it up for fun.
He just pulled it from a different one, you know.
Oh, yeah. You're looking at the wrong TPS form. Mm-hmm. That was on the other one from last week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Right. So that is the end of the he committed suicide theory. Let's now move into Craig Button was murdered theory.
Yeah.
Because this one is, this is interesting is how I'm going to put it. There's a gentleman by the name of William W. Warwick IV.
I've read some of his stuff.
I have too. I've read a lot of his stuff, actually. And he makes a lot of claims. He has connected this story to some UFO sightings, and he's generally made a big stink on the internet about it. So
didn't he also try to connect this to like 9/11?
You know, he may have, and I probably just didn't go that far through his stuff.
It's kind of hard to figure out how you could do that, but you know.
He's very creative in his ways. Mm-hmm. He's a very creative man. So here is what Warwick says. On the 13th of March, 1997, a series of unexplained lights are seen in the night sky over Phoenix. That is what is commonly referred to as the Phoenix Lights.
Yeah, famous mystery.
And it is a UFO sighting. It is something that we may talk about in the future. So I'm just going to give the barest, simplest description of the event, which is that stationary lights were seen and described. They were first described as a pair, and then there was a third, and then a fourth light, and then they went out, and then a new set of three lights appeared. Supposedly smaller lights were peeling off of them and then coming back to them. And then there was also a triangular formation of lights that were seen in the sky at a different time and a different location of Phoenix. So there's this whole thing, like the whole city is freaking out because they see lights in the sky. That is the simplest version of the Phoenix Lights.
Yeah. But I mean, I've read a little bit about the Phoenix Lights, but actually it wasn't like everybody in the city saw these things, right?
No, but a lot of people reported it.
Yeah,
a lot of people did.
But I mean, out of the population of Phoenix, really a tiny percentage actually reported it, right?
I can't answer that. I don't know. But the basest looking into the Phoenix Light, because I was really focused on what this guy's theory was for this.
Yeah.
I didn't want to cover the Phoenix Lights. That way we have it open to someday talk about it there.
Oh, okay. We've already spoiled it.
So no spoilers from Joe. But I will, because here's what the U.S. Air Force says. They said that they actually had a set of A-10s flying a nighttime mission in the area at that time, and they're responsible for the stationary lights, because what was happening is they were on a nighttime practice bombing run, but rather than dropping munitions, or live munitions even more so, what they were doing instead is they were dropping flares.
Parachute flares.
Yeah. Oh. It makes total sense.
Yeah.
Well, if you think about flares from a far distance on a parachute floating through the sky, you could see how people would say, oh, well, that's a weird, it's a stationary set of lights. That's mm-hmm. really strange. There's two, now there's three, now there's four.
Totally.
So this is the Air Force's description of the events. Warwick claims that it is a complete and total cover story, and that the lights really are UFOs, and that the U.S. Air Force is covering, for some reason, for the ETs that were there.
Because of course they are.
That's
literally what the U.S. Air Force does.
Mm-hmm. And Button, he was possibly a member of the flight crew that was covering or chasing the aliens. Mainly, he makes his connection, I think, because it was A-10s and Button's an A-10 pilot, but that's just my guess. Mm-hmm. But Button, hearing all of this stuff 4 years later that's going on about the Phoenix Lights, decides that he's going to blow the whole thing wide open, and the U.S. Air Force realizes that their only course of action is to kill him.
Of course.
Of course.
Aren't there better ways than this?
Well, here's the great thing. This is how he makes a lot of suppositions here, and this is the one I like the best, which is they decide to simply remotely control his plane and fly it into the mountainside for him, thus silencing him during this training run. So they make him do some weird behavior and then just fly away.
Uh-huh.
The U.S. Air Force then, I guess this kind of goes in two different directions. They could have flown it into the mountain in Colorado, or they could have just crashed his plane during the training mission.
That would have been simpler.
That would have been simpler, because going all to Colorado is a giant pain in the butt. But then what they would do, remember, we found a plane in Colorado that was an A-10. They would have taken wreckage from an A-10 and deposited it onto the mountainside along with his body, and then later on, quote-unquote, found it to then keep their whole story stitched together.
Easy.
How's this sound to you guys so far?
I don't know.
Well, go ahead.
I guess I would say, like, the zombie plane theory makes a lot of sense to me. This is something that they talk about. We talked about a little bit maybe with MH370, or they are talking about with MH370.
With hypoxia, you mean?
No, that they would have killed him and then remote controlled the entire time. From takeoff to landing, they
wasn't actually pilot controlled, mm-hmm. as in pilot in the cockpit, controlled.
Right? Ever,
yeah.
And that they would have done the whole mission so that the other people who were doing the mission could have corroborated the story that, oh yeah, he was totally in the air with us and he was alive, and then he went off and did his own thing, and like who knows what happened, and that none of them would be in on it, but that the higher ups would go and crash him into the side of a mountain, the closest mountains they could find. Which is probably about Colorado.
Well, no. here's the deal.
It's probably about Colorado.
Okay.
The closest uninhabited mountains?
You don't?
No.
You know, there's mountains are not the only hard surface on the planet, believe it or not.
Turns out the planet itself is quite hard.
Yeah. And,
turns out. Yeah.
And it turns out for something like that, if you really need to kill him, you just have your hitmen stab him or strangle him. And in order to remote control a plane all the way to Colorado, you got to have somebody in the air with the controller, and you got to have somebody who installs it on the plane.
So there's a whole thing, and I have not heard of this. We are able to remotely control an A-10. You would think that you would not want to have that ability on a plane so that your enemy could not hijack your own plane against you.
Well, you're not going to leave that stuff just routinely installed. But that's my point: is that in order to remotely control one, you'll have to have a whole team of guys develop all this stuff and install it on the plane.
Just to take out one dude.
Yeah.
Or technically, possibly take out two, as we're going to find out.
Yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm. But it'd be a lot easier just to put a bomb on the plane.
Yep.
Very easy to do. You can have something that's detonated by an altimeter, and you only need one assassin to do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or better still, just murder him in a parking lot somewhere. And that way you don't lose.
Claim it's a random crime.
Yeah, you don't lose an expensive airframe.
Okay, so we're all in agreement that this is kind of fetched in the farthest reaches of the land. But I'm going to keep going with it.
It's not actually as absurd as the idea that they killed him somewhere else and then just got some random wreckage from an A-10.
Let me keep going with this, because this is where this goes.
This is Warwick again.
He is saying that. Okay, what's an obvious clue that they planted this thing there? Well, one of the things is that the search helicopters, when they were looking for him, they saw paper fluttering around on the mountainside, and that's how they figured out, and then they saw the metal, and they figured out they were in the right spot. And he says, well, how can there be paper there when he drove the plane into the mountain, and how would paper survive the obvious fireball that was going to happen?
Well, I guess more of my question is, like, how would paper survive the, onslaught of snow?
It was a map. Supposedly it was just flight maps that were just kind of blowing around.
But like snow and stuff.
I don't know that it had been snowing or if it was just really cold, crappy conditions, but they said that there was paper flying around. Okay. And it was supposedly a map. Okay. But if we keep going with this, they then say that because there's further evidence that this is going on, is that 2 weeks after he died, or after his accident, he dies, there is a U.S. Air Force captain named Amy Zvadoba. I'm going to hope is how you pronounce her name. She died in a A-10 accident as well. And according to him, and this is totally according to work, I haven't seen this anywhere else, she was his trainer when he was in Texas.
Oh.
So this is a giant leap of faith that he is saying. Now, there's a lot of problems. Obviously, as we talked about, there's the whole remote controlling of a plane. It's really weird. And I also have to push back on there would have been this giant fireball, so there shouldn't have been any paper. Because one of the things that you need to have for a giant fireball is a fuel source. When they did the math, they figured out that at the very most, when his A-10 crashed into the side of Gold Dust Peak, it had maybe 5 minutes of fuel left, if any. So this thing, he was running on empty, which means when he went in, there would have been some fire, but it wouldn't have been as if he went in with a full tank and it is a giant movie scene style explosion.
Yeah,
that incinerate everything.
Yeah, things don't explode, generally speaking, like they do in the movies.
No. But autopilot is a thing, right?
It is.
So, like, the autopilot could have been switched on. It doesn't need to be remote control, like, following around.
Could have been autopilot.
It could have been autopilot. He could have just run out of fuel.
You're going into our next theory, actually.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. So let's go there. Because the next theory is that he was incapacitated and or it was an accident. So the theory goes that there is talk that he suffered some kind of accident. We're pretty sure that it couldn't have been hypoxia because that should have shown up in his blood work, as far as I understand it, at least.
That's what I heard,
but
too.
But for some reason other than that, he was rendered unconscious and the plane was on autopilot almost the entire time. Now, that's kind of easy to discount because of the fact that at the last 20 minutes or whatever it was, he was seen changing elevation, zigzagging back and forth, going through cloud formations. Like, that's not what an autopilot does.
Mm-hmm. Plus, autopilots don't shut off all your radios and your transponders.
Exactly. That's also a very, very good point. And if there was a problem, why wouldn't he have simply ejected the plane from the plane? Because, by the way, when you eject it sends out a beacon, you know, it's a come find me, rescue me kind of beacon automatically on purpose. Though I seem to remember somewhere that pilots of the A-10s could shut that off so that the enemy couldn't find them. But that's off the back of my head. I pull that. I'm not sure exactly.
No, but that would make sense.
It does make sense. I'm pretty sure that you can.
Yeah, but I mean, this whole he had some kind of accident that incapacitated him, and then he flew on autopilot till he suddenly woke up and then, crashed into the mountain. It makes me think of like something that would happen in the epic chicken fight scene from Family Guy. Mm-hmm. Now, this is like one of those random things, and they fall through and they hit a plane and, you know, something happens.
Yeah.
So it's really out there, and there isn't actually any evidence to support that it was just some random weirdo accident. I don't know. I mean, I want it to be just some random accident. I mean, I want it to be he was on autopilot and he came to and he realized he's out of fuel and he's trying to search for some place to land, but just nothing that really shows that's what he was doing. It doesn't make any sense because, like we talked about, he could have turned everything back on to find somewhere to go.
Yeah, he could have decided to go rogue and everything and somehow got lost in the clouds and didn't realize there was a mountain in front of him.
He could have misjudged his descent because, like we said, he hit 100 feet from the peak. Could have been, let's say he was out of fuel and he was just gliding. He may have thought, I've got this, I've got this, I've got this. Oh crap, I don't got this.
Yeah.
But then again, why not punch out? Why not get out of the airplane at that point? So, I don't know. It's really strange.
If he actually was in clouds and didn't realize he was about to fly into a mountain, then boom.
That's a good point. If he was gliding through cloud cover thinking he was safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he misjudged his position.
And it could have been he needed to be 100 feet to the right or the left of where he impacted. That's the end of did he commit suicide? Was he killed? Was it an accident?
I just don't like any of those.
I don't either, to be quite honest. I've ping-ponged all over the place on this one.
No, it's inexplicable. Know. Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on to mystery number two, which is what happened to the Mark 82s? So, the first theory of the Mark 82s is that he did not actually drop them. Like I said, the U.S. Air Force, they scoured everywhere and they don't find them. Ground penetrating radar, metal detectors, they're pretty sure that the weapons aren't armed. The reason I think that they believe they weren't armed is that if they had been armed upon impact,
they would have gone bluey.
They would have gone bluey, and that 2,000 pounds of munitions would have made a very big impact.
Oh, 500 pounds?
Well, no,
you mean 500 times 4.
Yeah, 500 times 4, exactly. Sorry, I was doing math. I'm not known for doing math.
You aren't.
I'm not. I admit it. So it's that 2,000 pounds of munitions would have made a big hole in the ground. And
somebody would have reported that probably.
They should have seen that.
It would have
would have blown the snow off the ground, I'm guessing. I went to the manufacturer's website, because you can find this stuff on the internet, to look up what does the Mark 82 do, and
it blows up.
It blows. They are engineered to blow up, but they make a crater that is anywhere from 15 to 30 feet in diameter, or 5 to 10 meters, and they make a crater that is anywhere from 3 to 13 feet deep, or 1 to 4 meters. So a single one makes that size hole. All four together should have made a really big hole. Mm-hmm. Something I will bring up, because this is something I thought about initially, was, well, what if the bombs didn't go off initially, but then in the crash and the heat of the fire, they went off? And that is something that can happen. There's a term, it's called cooking off. Cook off. And that is when an external heat source or thermal source affects a munition to the point that it sets it off. It makes it explode. Like, you know, it falls into the burning hull of a ship, which happens in naval accidents. And eventually the fire causes those to go off, which is then a whole series of problems. Well, you would think that, except like we talked about, he had almost no fuel left on the plane.
Yeah.
So there wouldn't have been enough heat to cause cook-off, because these things are rated for 2.5 minutes of high temperature. Mm-hmm. So,
well, plus also the bomb should have been torn off the wings when he hit, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And those, you know, what are we calling them?
The
grabber thingies?
The clamps?
The clamps, yeah.
The clamps!
The clamps. Yeah. Give them the clamps. Would have obviously been destroyed if a bomb had exploded.
Well, the wings should have been destroyed. There should have been evidence of the explosives in terms of residual chemicals. Should have been obvious when they analyzed the parts.
Yep.
Should have been pieces of shrapnel laying around.
There should have been shrapnel mile or so away.
But some closer, too.
Yes, so there's all these things that would indicate if they had gone off, and none of that indicates that was the case, and if they hadn't gone off, they should have just been laying in the wreckage. So that means that the didn't drop them theory is kind of on shaky ground. So we're now going to go into he did drop them.
Okay.
I read a really interesting article which pointed out a really good thing that I had not thought of at all, which is the effect of that 2,000 pounds of munitions on his fuel.
Mm. Not to mention the extra air drag.
The drag is going to cost him fuel, and he probably could not have made it nearly as far as he did had those weapons been on board the whole time.
Now, he only traveled about 850 miles, though, right?
You know what? When I tracked it, I had it at 650, but I've seen it called 800 miles, so we're just going to stick with 800 miles.
Okay.
So, yes, he traveled about 800 miles total, which is, I mean, the range, we were looking this up earlier, the range of a fully fueled Warthog is something like 2,500 miles. Mm. So he obviously wasn't full of fuel when he went down, or when he started his journey.
Yeah, apparently not.
Yeah. So the likely answer here then, based on that fuel consumption issue, is that he must have dropped them. And these folks really point out, they make a good argument, which is that he probably dropped them right away because he was in an area that was known for being a practice range.
True.
So it's entirely possible that he could have dropped them unarmed. Let's say he dropped them unarmed and they fall into this firing range. They could have been buried by subsequent explosions from other bombs that are dropped in practice runs, or maybe they were hit, a direct hit set them off. I know the chances of that are really minute, but it's something that could have happened. But wouldn't, and if they were live, good luck discovering that crater from the 8,000 craters that are next to it.
Yeah. Well,
and saying, also, this is obviously from Craig Button's flight.
Yeah, the other thing, too, is, you know, these things have fins on them. They're gonna go in kind of like
at an angle
down, and they have a sharp little nose on them.
Mm-hmm.
They could just bury themselves in the ground.
Yeah.
They could. Actually, yeah. Have you guys seen the... Did you ever do any looking at the fins that are available for these things?
Mm-hmm.
They what is it? The snake eye? Is that the one that they caught? They have that is... it's just weird.
Yeah.
It's this fin that, you know, you think of fins on a missile and they're upright and it, you know, kind of guides it. Well, this is
like
actually...
on a dart.
They're a parachuting fin and they create drag. They flare out and the wind pushes them and it slows the bomb down.
Yeah, it's not exactly a parachute, but yeah, they flip out and there's this four of them and they're just, you know, same place that the fins would be,
yeah.
But they slow it down.
Yeah, and yeah. So it was really interesting. But that is one thing, if the Mark 82s were equipped with something like that, I wouldn't be as willing to say maybe they nosed it and buried themselves because those fins are meant to slow them down.
Mm-hmm. I didn't see any mention that they had that special kind of
They didn't
Mark
mention
82.
Anything in the reporting
yeah.
of
yeah.
what these things were equipped with other than they were the basic Mark 82.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that, it seems like that's what you would train with, right? You train with the cheapest.
Oh, yeah. You don't put the fancy
stuff,
things on there.
Right?
We're going to give you the fully decked out rig the first time. Good luck.
Perfect.
Yeah. Well, they're, the snake eyes, if that, I can't remember. I'm pretty sure that's what it was. But
the fins that we were talking about?
Yeah, those are for really, really low altitude.
They are in slow movements because the idea, for everybody that's listening, the idea here is that if this fin is not there, the bomb will drop and strike the target fast enough that it will throw shrapnel back up into the plane that actually dropped it. So that's why they're slowing it down to give the plane time to get away.
Exactly. And so,
at its low airspeed.
Yeah, so he was only into his A-10 training course for, what, 2 months?
2 months. So he's probably, and this was his first live ammo run.
Yeah.
Chances are good he wasn't running those.
No. Yeah, it was not a low-level one.
No.
Yeah,
no. Okay. So which means that they should have had enough speed that, yeah, possibly in a very tilled-up gunnery range, the things could have very easily buried themselves.
Yeah.
But that doesn't explain why then they would say that it didn't look like the racks had been disengaged. So that...
Well, I don't know. The more credible sources I've seen say that the racks look like the bombs have been dropped.
And I would believe that. But the racks not being disengaged idea leads us into our last sub-theory of what happened to the Mark 82s, and that is the he sold them or gave them away theory. And you will see this out there occasionally, and this is one of those theories that gets bandied about, and when it comes up, it's usually followed by that person, the name of that person's favorite terrorist organization, and the theory basically goes, Craig Button, he flies somewhere, he lands, they unload the bombs, and then he takes off. Okay, why he then takes off and flies into a mountain? Well, maybe he wasn't actually on the plane. Maybe he did actually punch out and he had a dead body in the cockpit, or maybe he, you know, was a pig or a decoy or something like that. You know, so he got away a la D.B. Cooper. But, you know, you would think, well, the U.S. Air Force should know that, A, the frickin' the ejection seat is gone and this is a pig. But then again, hell... if we're going to keep going this way, maybe they're in on it. And so they're covering the whole thing up, which adds even more layers of absurd complexity to this whole story.
Well, you know, the cockpits in these things are not exactly roomy.
You can't
exactly. And also smuggling a corpse across the airfield and climbing into the plane with it, you know, with nobody noticing it.
Yeah.
What I was getting at is that if he, when he stopped at his clandestine airport drop,
that's when they loaded the extra corpse in.
That's when they loaded in the extra corpse. And hell, you know, maybe he did some fancy MacGyver WYSIWYG stuff with a computer and phew, it took off on autopilot by itself. And then the pig woke up and the pig was steering the plane. And that's why it went back and forth.
No, that only makes sense.
Huber, Wilbur realized that there was a problem.
Yeah. I guess that was kind of the reason I was asking, like, was he an exceptionally talented pilot? Was it possible that the Air Force was looking to do something kind of clandestine and they were looking for somebody to
and
do
he
this
was
mission,
tapped for that?
And he's tapped for that and they said, we're going to pay you a bunch of money, just get out of here. I don't think it's likely, but, you know, that was, I guess, why I was kind of asking.
I got you.
But
so he went
off
and bombed, like, a cannabis farmer or something like that.
Well, or just, you know, they were trying to sell these munitions or whatever that he flew.
It was
someplace.
Some black ops, black book operation of some kind.
Something like that.
Yeah, I don't.
It seems really unlikely.
It sure does.
Everything in this entire story seems super unlikely. So I guess I'm just as willing to say, you know, my UFO theory is that he was abducted by aliens.
That's
and they stole
possible.
The munitions because they wanted to investigate what humans were capable of. And then they dropped him back into airspace and suddenly he was like, I don't know where I am. I don't know what's going on. I just got abducted by aliens. Into the side of a mountain.
Well, if we're going to go with that, then he should also be shouting, why is this big chicken punching me?
Yeah.
Because that's just as likely.
Well, they're all
as likely. Yeah.
There's another possibility.
Okay.
Maybe he took something. Like, you know, don't laugh. There's always ergot, of course. But also,
sorry, I wasn't supposed to laugh.
Also, he could have eaten some mushrooms, not realizing that they were the special kind, or something like that. Or somebody slipped him some LSD. There's always all kinds of weird. I mean, there's stuff like that can cause a psychotic break.
That is not outside the realm of possibility.
Absolutely no evidence, of course.
Thank you.
And of course, they didn't find anything in his bloodstream. Yep.
So that's the hard part.
In fairness, though, it doesn't always take drugs to have a psychotic break. He could have had a psychotic break.
Yeah,
it's true.
He could have thought that he was being chased. That's why
could have been hallucinating
was,
in some way, know, shape, or form.
Doing these evasive maneuvers and through the clouds and stuff like that. But it doesn't explain where the bombs went or anything. So
yeah. Maybe the bombs will turn up.
Maybe.
I mean, they scoured those lakes, every lake around there, for example. That would have been a logical place for him to drop the bombs.
It would have.
In a lake. It totally would have. But most lakes in places like that tend to have very silty bottoms.
Mm-hmm.
They could vary. And it took them a long time to get around to searching those things.
But they were it wasn't as, totally I mean, they were, they had divers, they were using equipment, you know, metal detectors and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
You think that they would have found them. Well,
They had metal detectors? They had metal detectors then.
I know that they were using metal detectors, and I remember seeing images of guys walking through water, and they had these weird handle contraptions, part of which were in the water because they were doing the searching, which I believe was some sort of radar or metal detecting device. I don't remember now that you ask me. If you hadn't asked me, I probably wouldn't be able to do it unprompted, but that's the way it always works.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess I don't have a good theory for either.
I don't either.
No, me neither.
All right.
I think he just went nuts.
Yeah.
So it's a unanimous, it's Family Guy's
it's
fault.
It's a unanimous UFO.
All right. Yeah, okay. Well, let's go ahead and give you the important bits that I know everybody likes to hang on for. First off, we do have a website. That website is...
We do.
That website is thinkingsidewayspodcast.com. You can go there and find this in all episodes. There will be some links for from our research for each and every episode.
Of course.
On there, you will also find links to merchandise and stuff like that. We are, of course, obviously on iTunes, and we are also on just about every streaming service that is out there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're listening to us on iTunes, subscribe, take the time to leave a comment and a rating.
Five stars.
We appreciate those. If you're on a streaming service that allows you to do that, Google Play, I know everybody's using now, but I don't think it does a rating system yet. But, you know, if what you're using does, please do so. Now, we're on social media. We are on Facebook, where we have the Facebook group and the Facebook page. So like the page, join the group. Lots of fun stuff going on the group. We are on Twitter, where we are Thinking Sideways without the G in the middle. And we are on subreddit, where we are Thinking Sideways.
We have a subreddit?
We have a subreddit. We're on Reddit. We have a subreddit.
We are all over Reddit. We are all over the Reddit. We Reddit everywhere.
We are on the Reddit?
Okay. Yes. Yes. Devin is turning red it right now.
Yep.
Okay. So if you want to go ahead and get a hold of us, you can do so through Facebook or the Reddit or Twitter. Or if you want something that's going to be just directly us, you can always go ahead and send us an email.
Yeah, that
email,
works.
Email address is thinkingsidewayspodcast@gmail.com. And last but certainly not least, if you want to help support the show, we appreciate that. And there's a number of different ways to do that. On the right-hand side panel of our website, we have merchandise. So we've got links to both Zazzle and Redbubble, where we have shirts and stickers and phone cases and all kinds of fun stuff. We are also, we have a PayPal account. So if you want to do a one-time donation to us, that's awesome. Ooh, that's cool.
Thank you.
And there's a button right there to do it. Or if you want to do it on a recurring basis, you want to support the show, you can do that through Patreon, which is Patreon. So patreon.com/thinkingsideways. And every time that an episode comes out, you have pledged a certain amount, and that is what you would donate to the show per each of those episodes.
Yeah, just for the weekly shows, not for the shorts.
Yeah, Joe says this all the time. We haven't done a short in forever.
Yeah.
I know.
Almost like a year.
We should probably do one.
We've been saying that for a year. I think that people miss our shorts.
There's so many jokes there. I'm going to leave that alone.
I know.
All right. Well, we are going to go ahead and button this one up, and we'll talk to you next week.
Ta-ta.
I'm ejecting.